Okay, 2 Samuel, which follows what book? 1 Samuel. In front of what book? 2 Samuel is in front of 1 Kings. Okay. Yeah. Okay. 2 Samuel, and you have the notes in front of you there. 2 Samuel gives us highlights and failures of David's 40-year reign as king. So that in a nutshell is what 2 Samuel is about. The highlights and failures of David's 40 years reigning as the king of Israel. As we saw last week, 1 and 2 Samuel are one book in the earliest Hebrew manuscripts that we have. And the book in Hebrew, in its oldest form, is called simply Samuel. Then, shortly before the time of Christ, when the Septuagint was translated, that's the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, that was done a few years before the time of Christ. It was the edition of the Old Testament that was so much used by Jesus and the disciples. In the Septuagint, it was divided into two books, and then you added to it the two books of 1 and 2 Kings, and then the whole thing was called the books of the kingdom. So you had the first book of the kingdom, second book of the kingdom, third, and so on. Then it was after that again, the Hebrew text and the English versions then divided it into 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. And let me get some notes out on the back table there. Yep. Okay. Now, who's the author? The author is unknown. We do not know who wrote 1 and 2 Samuel. But there have been some guesses that have been made, particularly by the Jewish scholars. Jewish tradition names Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. That's G-A-D, Gad, as the possible authors of both 1 and 2 Samuel. Where do they get that? Well, they get it from a good source. They get it from the Bible. And it's from 1 Chronicles chapter 29. 1 Chronicles chapter 29 and verses 29 and 30 of 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 29. Now, the acts of King David from first to last are written in the Chronicles of Samuel the seer, and in the Chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and in the Chronicles of Gad the seer. So, evidently, Samuel, Nathan, and Gad did write histories of what happened during the time that we have 1 and 2 Samuel. And so probably 1 and 2 Samuel is a compilation of the writings of those three. It's a good, very good possibility. The time span for 2 Samuel is 40 and a half years, and that pretty much coincides with the reign of David, because 2 Samuel begins right after King Saul died. King Saul died in the last chapter of 1 Samuel. 2 Samuel is going to open up with another account of Saul's death, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then 2 Samuel ends just before David dies. And then David dies at the beginning of 1 Kings. The theme of the book is, of course, David's reign. That is very simple. What about Christ in 2 Samuel, as we've been seeing with every Old Testament book? What does that book contribute to us concerning our knowledge of Christ? Well, in Christ, the promises of God's covenant with David in 2 Samuel 7 are fulfilled. Now, we're going to look. It's a very important thing. We dare not go through 2 Samuel without spending some time in chapter 7 with the promises that God made to David concerning the kingdom. And those promises are fulfilled in Christ. So Christ is a very important subject in the Old Testament book of 2 Samuel. The structure of the book, I put here something from Mark Dever that I thought was very, very well put. Mark Dever is a pastor in Washington, D.C., if you've not run into him, and just a great Bible teacher, writing good books and so on. He's written 2 volumes that are doing with the Old Testament and the New Testament like what we're doing, where there's 1 chapter per Old Testament book in the Old Testament volume, 1 chapter per New Testament book in the New Testament volume. In his chapter on 2 Samuel, he says, quote, "The book's structure is fairly simple. The first 10 chapters are good things. The next 10 chapters are bad things. And the last 4 chapters are a bit miscellaneous. In chapter 21, David sorts out an old sin and its implications from Saul's reign. In chapter 22, David sings a psalm of praise to God. It also appears as Psalm 18. Chapter 23 contains David's last words, and chapter 24 contains 1 last story about the sin David commits by numbering the troops. Honestly, chapter 24 can feel like, oh yeah, and we wanted to include this story from David's reign. There it is, 2 Samuel. Well, we're going to take a little more time than that to go through the book and see what's in the book. And our outline is by Ray Stedman from his book, Adventuring Through the Bible. First of all, the major divisions of the book, you have King David, the road to dominion. Turning the page, you have King David, worship and victory in chapters 6 to 10. Then a little bit down the page, King David, failures and forgiveness at chapters 11 to 20. And then turning the page to page 37, you have the appendix, the lessons learned by King David. So turning back to page 35, let's just work our way through 2 Samuel. So we have, first of all, King David, the road to dominion. First of all, David's reign over Judah. That's in chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 7. Now, when we open up the book of 2 Samuel, for the first time in 10 years, David and his men are not fugitives. For so much of the book of 1 Samuel, they were fugitives. On the run from Saul, because if Saul could have gotten a hold of David, he would have killed him. But now they're no longer fugitives, and things settle down. And in chapter 1, though, it begins the book by repeating the story of Saul's death. However, when you read the two, you see they don't jive. Something is wrong here. In 1 Samuel, Saul is at the end. He knows that he's going to die. And rather than let a Philistine come and finish him off, he falls on his sword and so on. 2 Samuel, though, chapter 1, a man comes to David who happens to be an Amalekite, that group of people that pop up every once in a while that are a real problem. But he happens to be an Amalekite, and he comes to David and he tells them how David and Jonathan and, or excuse me, Saul and Jonathan and Saul's other sons have died at Mount Gilboa in the battle. And he said that he came upon Saul and he was injured and so on. And so this Amalekite says that he finished Saul off. Now, David doesn't have CNN and Fox News and cell phones and everything like we have today. This is the first news that he's gotten of the battle. He has not heard any other account. And he believes it. He has no reason not to believe it. And this Amalekite told that to David, thinking that since David would now become king, that David's going to be very excited to hear this, and David might even reward him for finishing off King Saul. But instead, King David orders his men to execute the Amalekite and says, "How dare you kill God's anointed king?" That is part of the character of David all along, that he has seen the king as one who is anointed by God and put in place by God, and it is not his job to overthrow him. If he's going to be overthrown, God's going to do that. And just to make sure also that no one could ever blame David for Saul's death, David takes this step of having his men execute the Amalekite. Well, I think it becomes obvious when you read the two accounts that the Amalekite is lying, but David has no way of knowing that. But that's how the book begins. Then in chapter 1, verses 17 to 27, we have David's cry of grief for Saul and Jonathan. We can understand why he had grief for Jonathan. A lot of people would have a hard time understanding why he had grief for Saul, because Saul was an enemy when it gets right down to it. Saul was trying to kill David, and yet David never looked at Saul as an enemy. And he saw him as God's anointed king, and Saul was his father-in-law, and Saul was the father of his best friend Jonathan. And he has genuine grief for both Saul and Jonathan, even though he was wronged by Saul. And this song that these verses are, that David composed, make it very clear that David had no grudges against King Saul. These verses, 17 to 27, are considered by people who study literature, and I'm using that term in a term much broader than Bible, but study literature, whether it be the Greek literature such as Homer and the Iliad and that kind of thing. People that love to study literature love to read this by King David and say it's one of the most beautiful pieces of literature that has ever been written. Now, of course, for the believer, we look at it as more than literature. It is the inspired word of God. But it is quite a moving song to sing or to read. And among the things we should take note of in it, actually before the actual song, just introducing the song, in verse 18, "And he said it and taught it to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Yashar," he said. And Yashar is an ancient Hebrew book. It's not inspired scripture, but it is ancient Jewish history that has different songs in it relating to victories and blessings that God has given his people. And evidently, when David wrote this, it was put in this book of Yashar, and then eventually included in 2 Samuel. But we don't have the book of Yashar today. It's been lost. Well, all we know about it are things that we read about it, such as here. Verse 26 is a verse we should comment on. "I am distressed for you and my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." It's a great statement by David concerning this tremendous bond that David and Jonathan had. But do not read into it anything sexual. Unfortunately, that has been done by the homosexual community. They will lift this verse out and say, "See, David was a homosexual." that's not the implication at all, coming out of that culture. That is simply a way of speaking that they had this very special, unique relationship. He's praising Jonathan because Jonathan had such self-denial. Jonathan would have been the heir to the throne. Jonathan should have been the next king if you're going to do it by dynasty. But God has overthrown Saul's dynasty. God has made it clear that we're going to get a new dynasty. We're going to get a new king, and that's King David. But Jonathan would have been the heir to the old dynasty, and yet Jonathan knows that David is God's man and God's choice and gives up his own rights for David. And that is something that David could never get over and acknowledged numerous times. So it's a tremendous statement, and it is just a tragedy that it has been taken by the homosexual community for something that is an abomination to God, and that God certainly did not mean that in inspiring this verse. Verse 27 is a very famous verse, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. The end of this great statement of mourning for Saul and Jonathan. Well, then in chapter 2, verses 1 to 7, David is anointed king of Judah. That is not the whole nation of Israel. This is just the southern part of the country. Judah is the tribe that David is from. So there's a period of time that goes on before the rest of the nation acknowledges David as king. And what happens is that Saul's head general, named Abner, tries to get another son, the one son of Saul who didn't die at Mount Gilboa. He stayed home, and he was the youngest. And he tried to get him accepted as the king of Israel. And so there's a period of years, 7 years, where David is reigning simply as the king of Judah, and his capital city is down in Hebron, the southern part of the country. So that brings us to number two on the outline, Ish-bosheth made king over Israel. Ish-bosheth is this young son of King Saul. Again, Saul's general Abner seeks to restore Saul's kingdom with Ish-bosheth as king. But when you read the story, you see that really Ish-bosheth was nothing but a puppet of Abner. He would never have stood as a king in his own right. Ish-bosheth winds up being killed by two of his own men. But interestingly, then David executes those two men for murdering Ish-bosheth. Again, there is no guile in David trying to become the king. And when Ish-bosheth is killed, then Israel unites to anoint King David over the whole nation of Israel. Then we have number three, David defeats Ish-bosheth. And then, as I said, later he's killed by two of his own men. So that, turning the page to page 36, then David reigns in Jerusalem over Israel, the whole nation. So for 3 years, he is king in the southern part, the tribe of Judah. Then for 33 years, he is king over the whole nation. So a total of being king 40 years. How many years was Saul king of Israel? 40. How many years was Solomon king? 40. And that's just one of those unique things. Okay. Number four, on page 36. David reigns in Jerusalem over Israel. Chapter 5, which tells this, records two significant victories for David. First, there's a victory over the Jebusites. And that victory over the Jebusites gave him control of their city, which is the great city of Jerusalem. Prior to this, the Jewish people did not have Jerusalem. It was a heathen city. It was a Jebusite city. Jebusites are part of all the otherites, the Canaanites and so on. It's an interesting story how David conquers Jerusalem. Jerusalem is an amazing capital city, an important city, amazing in the sense that it doesn't fit the mold of important cities. Every important city that I can think of except Jerusalem is built either on a coast with a port and an ocean or on a great river that can be navigated by ships. Think about it. New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, London, Paris, Moscow. They're all either on the coast or on a river. But there's one that isn't. It happens to be Jerusalem. And on top of that, Jerusalem is in a hilly area. It's kind of difficult to get to in those days. And yet that's the city that God chooses to be the capital city. And David is the one who conquered it. Therefore, it's called the City of David. Jerusalem, of course, like any city, needs water. They don't have a great source of natural water. They don't have a great river running through it. So the city is built adjacent to a little spring. And this spring bubbles up water. And the city wall is built in such a way that usually the people of Jerusalem in those days would come out of the city wall, and there they would go to the spring and they would get their water. But they knew that in time of warfare, that's not going to work. They're going to have to be able to get the water inside the walled city. So they built a tunnel a short distance to go under the wall, water, or under the wall, and then they built a platform in the city over that spot so that they could come and put their buckets down to get the water. Well, later on, King Hezekiah is going to enlarge that, and it's going to be a very significant thing that he does. But at the time of David, it what came in a short distance, and then it had this shaft that went up to the top, and the buckets would go down that shaft. Well, when King David conquered the city, there are much of the time that water is only waist deep, and you could easily wade through it, and I have waded through it. It's one of the fun things to do in Jerusalem. And you wade through it, and then you come to this shaft, and David and his men climbed up in the shaft and got into the city that way. And so today, you can go to Jerusalem, you can wade in. Now today, the tunnel goes further because it was lengthened by King Hezekiah. Therefore, it's called Hezekiah's Tunnel today, and that's an amazing story. But then you're going in there and you shine your flashlight up and you see that shaft that David and his men climbed through. And it's quite a military accomplishment that David and his men conquered Jerusalem. So chapter 5 records David's victory over the Jebusites, and it's very important because it gives them Jerusalem. Secondly, it records a victory over the Philistines. So between the Jebusites now and the Philistines, David's power is consolidated, and he's able to protect the nation of Israel. So that brings us to the second part of the book, King David, Worship and Victory, chapters 6 to 10. First of all, number 5, we have the movement of the Ark of the Covenant. That's in chapter 6. This is a very important story in the Bible, the story of Uzzah and the Ark. You remember that they're going to move the Ark to Jerusalem. And so they decide to do it in a very grand way. They get a cart. That's brand new cart and fitting for the occasion and some oxen and so on. And they put the cart on it. And they're carrying it into Jerusalem. And one of the oxen begins to totter, and they're afraid the ark's going to fall. And so Uzzah reaches out with his hand and touches the ark, and God strikes him dead. I mean, after all, he's doing a good thing, right? But the thing is, he's doing a good thing, but not in the way God said to do it. God had given specific instructions how the ark, which is considered the throne of God, something very important, because he had given instructions how the ark is to be carried. It had some rings on the side. You put poles through, and you carried the poles on your shoulder. And the Levites who had that job were trained over and over and over again how to do it. And yet they didn't do it God's way. And God did this. It's a reminder of God's holiness and that we are to do things God's way. So the attempt to get the ark to Jerusalem becomes a fiasco. But finally, they do it the right way, and it's a joyous occasion when they bring the ark into Jerusalem. And you remember David was out there dancing before the Lord, just exuberantly. And you know how people in the Middle East are. They can't just stand still, you know, and they move their arms. And David is out there exuberantly praising the Lord as he's leading the procession. And you probably know the story about his wife, the daughter of Saul, who just absolutely criticized him for that, and that he had made a spectacle of himself, and so on. And in there you'll read that he's there uncovered, and so on. Don't think of that as nakedness. It's very specific that he is wearing the simple ephod, like the priest wore. It's just a very simple, plain robe type thing. Michael thinks he should be out there in royal robes and just displaying majesty and glory, but he's just simply out there bringing praise to the Lord. And that's quite a scene in 2 Samuel. But then we come to number 6, David's covenant with God. He is forbidden to build the temple. God provides David an eternal house. Chapter 7. 2 Samuel 7 is one of the key chapters of the Bible because it contains what we call the Davidic covenant, the covenant that God made with Israel through their king David. God has made a covenant with Noah. He's made a covenant with Abraham. He's made a covenant with Moses, relating to the Jewish people. Now there's a covenant with David, the Davidic covenant. And how this came about was, oh, and by the way, the term covenant does not appear in chapter 7, but it does appear referring to this in Psalm 89, verse 3, and also in Chronicles. Well, how this came about, David wanted to build a house for the Lord. David by now lives in a fine palace made with cedar wood that was given, the wood was given by King Hiram up in Tyre, which is in Lebanon, with cedars of Lebanon and so on. Must have been a beautiful thing. And then he thinks of God's house is still the tent, the tabernacle. And he says, God should have a house. I want to build a house for God. And God communicates through the prophet Nathan that the answer is no. He cannot build a house for God. The reason is not given in 2 Samuel. It is given in Chronicles. And that is because David was a man of bloodshed. But God says no, but instead, God says, David, I won't let you build a house, but I will build a house. Not a house made of wood, but a house that is a dynasty. I'm going to build the house of David, a dynasty. And he promises in this covenant to David three eternal elements to the covenant. The first is an eternal dynasty. That is, that there will always be a king to reign over Israel. To do that, eventually we're going to have an eternal person. And of course, this person is Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. So he promises him an eternal dynasty. So David's going to have a son Solomon. Solomon's going to have a son Rehoboam. That is going to continue even to the point where the family, because of the sin of Israel, and the family of David is going to be taken captive by the Babylonians and taken into captivity. And they are going to wind up eventually in poverty. They're not going to be sitting on any great throne. They're going to be very poor people. And the prophet Isaiah prophesies that by the time the Messiah comes, he's going to come this root out of this very dry land. And that is all picture language of the desperate situation the house of David is going to become. But they're still going to be descendants of David. And in 70 AD, the city of Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, and with it all the records. So from 70 AD on, it has been impossible to trace any Jewish person's family back to David. I met a man in Jerusalem some years ago who claimed to be a descendant of David, and he wore a robe and he had a harp, and he would play the harp for the tourists and claim to be a descendant of David. He cannot prove it. So the Messiah, the ultimate descendant of David, had to come on the scene before 70 AD. And of course, Jesus Christ did. Jesus, when you read the genealogy in Matthew and in Luke, the genealogy of Jesus, you discover he is the one qualified as a son descendant of David. Luke's genealogy is the genealogy through his mother, Mary. And Matthew's genealogy is the genealogy through his foster father, Joseph. And that becomes an interesting story that we'll just save till we get to the New Testament of how all that works together. But the bottom line is, because of a curse that was put on the line of David, when a king named Jeconiah was on the throne, no one from the line through Solomon is any more qualified to be the king. And then here comes Jesus. Through the bloodline of his mother is a descendant of David. She's not from the line of Solomon. She's from the line of one of the other sons of David. But Jesus has the blood of David, but through his foster father, he has the right to the throne without the curse. No one else has that qualification. And Jesus then is the eternal king. Jesus will reign forever and ever. And that makes this element of that Davidic covenant possible, an eternal dynasty. Then there is an eternal kingdom. And of course, the kingdom has come and gone in the sense that Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians, rebuilt, destroyed by the Romans, and so on. And the Bible promises a future kingdom for Israel that will have an eternal king. And that leads to the third element, an eternal throne. So you have an eternal dynasty, an eternal kingdom, and an eternal throne, all promised by the Davidic covenant. So, the Davidic covenant promises what family out of Judah the Messiah is going to come. Because since Genesis, where in Genesis 3:15 there's been the promise of a Messiah, and the first promise after the sin of Adam and Eve, there's a promise of a Messiah. The Messiah is going to be the seed of the woman. And then later we learn the Messiah is coming through a line through Noah, and then his son Japheth. And then it's narrowed down to Abraham, but Abraham has two sons, and it's narrowed down to Isaac, and then down to Jacob, but Jacob has 12 sons, and then it's narrowed down to Judah. But now, for the first time in hundreds of years of Bible history, it's been narrowed down to a particular family in Judah, the family of David. So 2 Samuel 7 is a very important chapter in the whole story of the coming of the Messiah. That brings us in the outline to number 7, David's military victories over the Philistines, Moab, Zobah, and Syria. And that's in chapter 8. David was a great military general, great military leader of Israel. Two verses in chapter 8 kind of summarize the first half of 2 Samuel. Let me read them. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 6. 6b, the second part of verse 6. Chapter 8, verse 6b, the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. That is a theme in the first half of 2 Samuel. And then, not only in verse 6, but also in verse 15, again, the second part of the verse, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. Again, first half of 2 Samuel, that's true. Then we come to number 8, the righteous reign of King David, chapter 9. There is an incident in chapter 9 that I think we should mention, and that is David's kindness to Mephibosheth. I love the story of Mephibosheth, always have. And Mephibosheth is a son of Jonathan. So he's the grandson of King Saul. David had promised Jonathan that if anything happened to Jonathan, David would be sure to take care of Jonathan's family. So after all of this turmoil has settled and David is reigning and the victories have been won, David remembers that promise. And he asks, is there any descendant of Jonathan around? And he learns that there is a son of Jonathan named Mephibosheth. And when Mephibosheth was a little boy, and Jonathan had been killed when Mephibosheth was a little boy, but when he was a little boy, he suffered some kind of injury to his feet and was unable to walk. And David shows mercy to Mephibosheth and sends out the order, bring him to me, bring him to my palace. Give him a place to live in my palace and put him at a place to sit at my table. And he just shares the riches that he has with Mephibosheth. And that becomes a wonderful picture of what Christ has done for us. That we are all undeserving, unworthy, crippled spiritually, and yet Christ has just poured out abundant mercy on us. It's a beautiful little story in 2 Samuel. Then we have number 9, the military victories over Ammon and Syria. Then we come, you remember Mark Dever said the first 10 chapters are good things and the second 10 chapters are bad things. Well, now we come to the bad things. King David, failure and forgiveness. Number 10, David commits adultery with Bathsheba, one of the most well-known stories in the Bible, even to non-believers. Non-believers love this story. It appeals to their interest in such things. Plus, you know, the non-believer always likes to see the people of God brought down a notch. And that certainly happens here. And it certainly is the big blot in David's life. You know the story of how it was evening, he's up on his rooftop, but he should never have been there. Because in the couple of verses before that, it said it's in the spring when the kings go out to war. In those days, you didn't typically have war in the winter. In the winter, it can be raining, you've got mud to deal with, and it's just a difficult time to have war. So they would have war in the spring and in the summer and in the fall. Same thing with the American Civil War and the Revolution. You read that in the winter, the armies went into camp and waited for the spring. So this is the springtime. It's time for the armies to go out to war. But then it says, but David stayed at home in his palace. And it appears he's really sleeping late. It almost gives you an impression it's just in the late afternoon that he's getting out of bed. And then just a little bit later when this incident occurs. So the problem for David starts long before he looks at Bathsheba. Problem starts, he wasn't doing what God called him to do, and that is to lead the army. But instead, he's taking it easy at home. And so you know the story of how he's up on the rooftop and he looks down. His house is on the highest hill, largest point in the city. Looks down and here he sees Bathsheba taking a bath. Now, it wasn't just a bath to take a bath, but the Hebrew terminology would mean she was doing the ritual bath, which would have been what the Old Testament law said that a woman was to do after her monthly period. Now that's an important factor in this because that tells anyone who would have any doubt that this baby that's going to be born was not Uriah's. She was not already pregnant when this incident occurs. Just to remove that anyone would ever have any doubt about that. So it's the ritual bath after her monthly period. And David sees her and he lusts for her. And that's why the Bible has such strong statements for men about their eyes. And even Job, who lived a long time before David, said, I have made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a maid. It's this idea of looking with lust and the very statement that later Jesus is going to make, that whoever looks with lust on a woman has committed adultery with her in his heart already. And so we are warned as men to be careful with our eyes. And David wasn't. And David should have known better. You read the things that David wrote in the Psalms and so on, that he was aware of the need for spiritual vigilance, but he's let his guard down. Coincides with his lazy lifestyle that he's living right now as the king of Israel. So he sees her, he lusts for her, calls for her, she's brought to him, and you know the rest of the story. And she conceives a child. So David commits adultery with Bathsheba. Then number 11, David murders Bathsheba's husband, Uriah. Bathsheba's husband is a very brave soldier in David's army. And when David learns that she is pregnant, he panics and he says, we've got to cover this up some way. So he calls for Uriah to come back to Jerusalem from the battle that's going on with the intention that Uriah will spend the night with his wife, and then after he goes back to battle and everyone learns that Bathsheba's pregnant, they will think, oh yeah, well of course Uriah was home and so on. So that explains it. But do you know the story that Uriah is more noble than David? And he says, how can I, when my men are putting their lives on the line up there in the battle, how can I go and spend a nice night with my wife? And he refuses to do it. And then David even goes further and he gets him drunk, trying to get him to let down his self-discipline and so on. And that doesn't work. And so then David decides he has to get rid of Uriah. And so he sends Uriah back to the battle with a sealed letter telling the commander of the forces to put Uriah at the front of the battle where he's going to be killed. And it's one of the ironies of history that Uriah faithfully obeys the king in carrying that order, never opens it, never breaks the seal, and it's his own death warrant, as it were. So Uriah's dead. David then takes Bathsheba as his wife, hoping that people just won't get too curious on looking at dates and so on. And he thinks that he has gotten away with sin, which, of course, Bible in the Pentateuch and the Law of Moses said that you cannot get away with sin. And but David has thought that he could. So that brings us to 12. David marries Bathsheba. Then 13. David, is confronted by the prophet Nathan. Nathan the prophet comes into the presence of the king, tells him a story. Story about a rich man who has so many lambs. And then he goes and he sees a little lamb over here that belongs to this poor guy, has just one lamb, and this man steals it and so on. And David gets incensed and says, that man should die. And Nathan says in the King James, thou art the man, one of the great statements of Scripture. And David's sin is exposed. What that story was portraying is rich David, who had multiple wives, seeing Uriah's one wife and taking her. And it is a dramatic, dramatic moment in the Bible. But God brings conviction to David's heart through that. And so number 14, David repents of his sin. And we have two psalms that talk about that, that David wrote out of that experience, Psalm 51 and Psalm 32. Then number 15, David's son dies. The son that was conceived by David and Bathsheba is born, and then he dies. And he lingers between life and death. And David is absolutely in mourning while that baby is dying. So much so that when the baby dies, the people around David are so afraid to tell him. They think, if he is this broken up before the baby dies, what's he going to be after the baby dies? And they don't want to give him the news. But finally, David can tell by their demeanor, and he asks them and they tell him. But instead of going further to pieces, he gets up and he washes himself. And he makes an amazing statement. Because they asked him, well, why are you doing better? And he said, he cannot come back to me, but I will go to him. That is a great statement concerning the believer's expectation at death for a reunion. And in this case, with a baby. And I think this is one of the clues in Scripture that babies and small children, when they die, that they go to be with the Lord. They're born sinners, because they're born with a sin nature. But God in his mercy, because they have not had opportunity to hear and respond and believe the gospel and so on. In his mercy, he takes them to be with himself. And some people have said, well, that's stretching it a little with David, because really that's just his way of saying, I'm going to join him in death. We're going to be in the same family tomb. Wait a minute. Psalm 23, David wrote. Where did David expect to go when he dies? I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The same David who said that is the same David who said this. I think he believed he would be in the house of the Lord with this little baby. And it's a tremendous, tremendous promise. This whole issue of infants dying and so on does trouble a lot of people, and certainly it's a very serious issue that it should. If you would like to dig into it further, I think the best thing I've seen written on it is written by John MacArthur, and I should have looked up the name of it before I came, and I forgot to do it. But it's an excellent little book, probably 60, 70 pages, covering the matter of the death of a little child. Dr. McGee has a good booklet on it called The Death of a Little Child. We've given that booklet out to numerous parents whose children have died. And I remember one family said they had many things given to them after the death of their baby, but that was the one that did the most help for them, was Dr. McGee's little booklet, which was written before John MacArthur's. I think John MacArthur's goes into a whole lot more detail. But anyway, it's just an idea. Well, going on in number 16 then, another son is given. And that's in chapter 12, verse 24 to 31. And that son's name is Solomon. And then number 15, incest in David's house, the murder of Amnon, the rebellion of Absalom, chapters 13 to 18. God forgives sin. David's sin is forgiven, but that doesn't mean there's not going to be consequences. And there are consequences. And Nathan said to David, you're going to have trial and violence and terrible things in your household as a result of the consequences of this sin. And that's what this section is about, such as chapter 13, David's oldest son, Amnon, repeats David's sin, only this time with the twist of raping his half-sister, Tamar. And David did nothing. Maybe part of that was David's guilt over his own sin, I don't know. But David does nothing about that. And then Absalom, Tamar's full brother, waits 2 years. And then he kills his brother Amnon. And Absalom flees. And again, David does nothing about it. And then in chapter 14, after 3-year exile, David brings Absalom back to Jerusalem. But again, no repercussions for Absalom. And then chapter 15, Absalom rebels against David and claims the throne. And David flees Jerusalem. Chapter 16, David goes east while Absalom consolidates his power in Jerusalem. Then in chapter 17, Absalom goes after David. In chapter 18, Absalom is killed. And you have David's grief in chapter 18, verse 33. He just cries out, Absalom, Absalom, my son. Oh, I wish it were me that had died. What a different reaction than to the death of the little baby. David doesn't have any expectation of seeing Absalom again. Very, very interesting contrast. Then turning the page, number 16, David is restored as king after the whole thing with Absalom. That brings us to the appendix, lessons learned by King David, taking some things out of the chronological order from earlier in his reign. such as 17 on famine, chapter 21. They're having a famine in the land of Israel. God tells David that the famine is a result of Saul's breaking the covenant with the Gibeonites. Remember the covenant with the Gibeonites? That's back in the book of Joshua, 400 years earlier, when Joshua was destroying the different Canaanite groups. The Gibeonites, who were their neighbors, said, "Wow, we don't want this to happen to us." So they came and they deceived Joshua. And Joshua should have been more discerning, more careful. Ask God about it, but he doesn't. And they come and they pretend like they're far, far away people. And would you make a covenant with us? And so Joshua says, sure, no problem, makes a covenant with them. But once you make a covenant, God says that's very serious. And Saul, back when he was reigning, he broke that covenant and killed some of the Gibeonites. And God says, you know, this famine is because of that. And so then David takes action concerning that, as Saul's some other sons of Saul who were not killed at Gilboa, killed to make atonement, to make atonement for what Saul did. Number 18, there's war with the Philistines. Number 19, Psalms of Thanksgiving to God. There's two psalms in this section. The first psalm is almost identical with Psalm 18 in the book of Psalms. And it's David's personal song here that then in Psalm 18 has been adapted for public singing and public worship. It was written after the covenant in chapter 7. I put an outline here thinking we'll go through it a little, but we won't have time. Number one, the Lord delivered David. Great, great words. Just speaking of the marvel of God's delivering David from his enemies. And number two, the Lord rewarded David. Number three, the Lord enabled David. And number four, the Lord established David. Then in chapter 23, verses 1 to 7, there's another song of David that's called The Last Words of David. Those last prophetic words from God prior to his death. And these words give praise to God for that covenant that God made. And let me just read two verses from that, chapter 23. Verses 3 and 4, 23, 3 and 4. The God of Israel has spoken. The Rock of Israel has said to me, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, and that's the position that David is in, as a king, he dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth on a cloudless morning. There's something about the sunshine right after dawn on a cloudless morning that is just so refreshing. Or like rain that makes grass to sprout from the earth. That is refreshing. It's a beautiful poetic language for the beauty of a king ruling in righteousness. And that was in the heart of David. That's what he wanted to do. That brings us back to the outline. Number 20, accomplishments of David's mighty men are listed here. Then number 21, David's third sin. Now, I mean, that doesn't mean the third sin he did in his life, but the third big sin that's in the book of 2 Samuel. And David's pride is the root of it. God didn't want the king to be going around taking a census, so that the king could say, look how great I am. I have this many men in the army and this many subjects and so on. But David decided he wanted to take a census. Now, there is an interesting little detail here. I said David decided he wanted to take a census. However, to be more precise, in 2 Samuel 24, verse 1, it says that God incited David to take a census. And then he's going to get punished for it. If it's evil to take a census, how could God tempt him to do evil? But then in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1, which is another account of the same incident, it says Satan incited David to take the census. So in other words, God allowed Satan to incite David. It's very much like in the book of Job, as Satan wants to do these things to Job. And God says, okay, I'll let you do it. Satan could never have done it with God's allowing it, and God allowed it. So you have the same kind of thing here. But as a result of what David did, this plague comes on the nation of Israel. And David wants to make things right, and he wants to bring a sacrifice to God. And so David buys a threshing floor right next to the boundary of the city of Jerusalem. And the threshing floor was the highest place in the community where they would thresh the wheat when the breeze came up in the evening. And David goes and he buys it so that he can build an altar there and he can offer a sacrifice to God. But that threshing floor is going to be the very place where later on Solomon is going to build the temple and becomes the focal point of the worship of God. So in 24, verse 25, the last verse of the chapter, you have David building there an altar. But in 1 Chronicles 22, verse 1, same incident. But in 1 Chronicles 22, 1, he adds the little detail that that is the same place where Solomon built the temple. And that's the place in Jerusalem. That's the most contested place still in Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, where you have the Muslim Dome of the Rock today. Well, that's a run through 2 Samuel. So next week we'll continue the story, as it were, with the next book, which is